Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. It's been another rocky week in transatlantic relations, you can say. We're right in the middle or right in the wake of Trump's announcement of his plans to reduce the U.S. troop presence in Germany. He's continued to accuse Germany of being kind of quote-unquote delinquent on its payments to NATO. And he continues to make claims about Germany treating the United States badly on things like trade. But I think it's more than just this Trump dynamic. I think we're also seeing a continuation of German public attitudes towards the United States still kind of at depressed levels. I think the last Pew poll I've seen was something like 34% of Germans saying the relationship with the United States is good. So U.S.-Germany relations are in a difficult place. And to take this issue on, we have decided to team up with some fellow podcasting kindred spirits, I guess you could say. We've got with us Dr. Ulrika Frank and Dr. Frank Sauer, who are two of the co-hosts of a German podcast that I'm going to slaughter the name of, but we'll say it. It's Zeker Heitzhalber. So how did I do, guys? Is that okay?
Well done.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah.
So we wanted to have kind of a melding of the minds to bring these two podcasts together and really tackle this question about U.S.-Germany relations. What's going on? How we got here? And what's really in store for U.S.-Germany relations? So welcome, Ulrika, and welcome, Frank.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Glad to be here.
Maybe we can jump right in on kind of the topic of the moment, which is this Trump announcement about the U.S. troop withdrawal from Germany. And just wondering kind of how you all are digesting this information. You know, how much do you think it actually has to do with Trump's belief that Germany is, you know, delinquent or owes the U.S. or NATO money in some way? Or do you think it has more to do perhaps with Merkel's decision to not attend the G7? So just want to hear your thoughts a little bit about kind of what you see as at play here, and really importantly, how this decision is being received and being responded and reacted to in Germany. So Ulrika, maybe we can start with you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I have to say at this point, it's all a bit unclear still. I mean, this isn't the first time, of course, that Donald Trump has said that he wanted to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Germany. I think it was almost exactly 2 years ago before a NATO summit that he said something similar. But now this seems to be more concrete. And so we're now talking of a reduction to 25,000, I think, U.S. troops in Germany. However, what isn't apparently completely clear is whether this is a reduction of the number of permanently stationed U.S. troops in Germany. At the moment, there are roughly some 34,000 U.S. troops in Germany, and then a reduction to 25,000, of course, would be about, you know, 10,000 less, or whether, and this is what Trump has suggested a few times, whether this is a reduction of the 52,000 maximum number of U.S. troops that can be in Germany at any one time. So these 52,000, these are troops that can rotate through Germany, be there for exercises and that kind of stuff. So if the U.S. was to reduce this upper limit number of 52,000 to 25,000, that would be a quite massive reduction. And that would be even more extreme than just reducing the numbers that are permanently stationed there. So basically, there's still a lot of open questions. I just did an interview with a local radio station from like southern Germany that has a lot of U.S. military installations. And they were already asking, like, is this going to concern us? Like, who are they withdrawing? And my answer was, we have no idea. We just don't know. There are a lot of different military installations in Germany that are there for a number of different reasons. I mean, from military hospital to Ramstein Air Base, which is important for drone operations, to the Africa Command in Stuttgart. So a lot of different installations, and we don't really know what will be cut and in what way.
Yeah, and in terms of, you know, reactions to Germany, it's probably not a big surprise to say that they differ depending on where you look. I mean, on the left, a couple of people have said, great, you know, go and go, all of you, and take your nukes with you. You know, we've had this big debate just a couple of days or weeks ago about nuclear sharing. because Germany is about to procure a new airplane as a replacement for the Tornado, and is in that frame of reference now debating which plane to get and if this nuclear sharing is still something that the government will hold on to. And so while the left is saying, you know, go and take all the nukes, the more conservative transatlantic crowd is, of course, quite shocked by all of that. I personally, I'm not losing any sleep over it, especially if you look at it from a deterrence perspective. You know, I've read probably more about nuclear deterrence and deterrence in general than is healthy for a human being. And I don't think that, you know, that the Russian war plan will now come out of the drawers because it says, you know, when the U.S. troop level drops below a certain threshold, we will launch full-fledged invasion of Western Europe. So I'm not really concerned in that regard. But of course, you know, in the wider frame of reference of NATO, it's not good. And I'm pretty sure it'll evoke, you know, two or three evil cackles from the Kremlin, because it's yet another point where we seem to be in great disagreement with regard to Europe in the US and the way we look at these things. Trump looking at this from a very transactional point of view, whereas Europe is looking at this more from a, you know, alliance building and, you know, burden sharing and, you know, holding on to common values points of view. And so, yeah, interesting times.
I think what's really been something that's aggravated the situation is that this issue has gotten caught up in U.S. and German politics as well. I mean, a lot of what Trump said, I think, certainly was revenge taking in terms of this thing he has about Merkel in Germany, which really is a mystery. What does he have against Germany? You know, he talks about it in terms of trade or in terms of free riding or something, but there's something particular about Germany more than any other ally that he seems to go against, and he feels that it's got resonance in his base. So I think one of the reasons he did this was revenge taking on Merkel and the G7. But the second thing is, I think he must have felt that this was something he could go before his base and say, promise fulfilled, you know, and as if this was something that his base even is familiar with. And then I understand too, and this is where you all know better, is within SPD in terms of German politics, this is a bit of an internal fight as well between certain factions trying to deal with nuclear sharing, but also just the role of Germany in European defense and security. So it's a pity that we're having to deal with this within a hothouse of politics.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I very much take your point about Trump's obsession with Germany and even Merkel personally. I remember writing a piece, I think like 3 years ago, where I said that I was really worried about the future of US-German relationships because of that, because it really seems that there are a number of things in German politics and with Merkel in particular that Trump just hates. I mean, whether it's kind of immigration policy, whether I think there's a kind of strong woman politician element to it, Russia politics, then the whole, you know, Germany being very strong on trade. I think there are many elements that Trump particularly hates, and that certainly doesn't help. In a way, this is the weird thing about this whole idea, because I mean, one can make a strategic point to reduce the number of troops in Germany if one wants to say we want to reduce the US footprint in the world. Now, one doesn't, you know, need to find that a particularly good idea, but I can see how that could make sense and say, okay, we're going to reduce overall troop deployments, bring the troops home, all of that. But this isn't really the argument that Trump is making at the moment. He's making an argument about kind of wanting to punish Germany for not spending enough on their own defense. And this is weird to me in particular because, and this is really a point I keep making over and over, the large majority of these US troops in Germany aren't there to defend Germany or Europe against Russia. I mean, it's not as if they're sitting at the kind of eastern border looking over the German or the Polish plains toward Russia and being ready to defend themselves. Rather, US military installations in Germany are there because you know, Germany is a staging ground for US operations. I mentioned the AFRICOM command, and there's the Euro command, military hospital, all of that. So these aren't troops that are there to defend Russia, to defend Europe against Russia or Germany against Russia. At the same time, of course, this troop presence in Europe and in Germany does contribute to deterrence and does contribute to reassuring European allies. And this is why, you know, so far in my view, this whole stationing in Europe and Germany has been a win-win situation, and that it was good for the US and it was good for Europe because it contributed to deterrence. And I'm just worried that withdrawing parts of these troops is going to be a lose-lose situation, because not only will it kind of weaken US capabilities, but it will also undermine European deterrence and just kind of the trust of the European allies in the US. So, I mean, Frank is absolutely right. It's not as if Russia is going to invade anytime soon because of that, but it just, you know, it just contributes to the overall undermining, I think, of the alliance. And that's what I'm worried about.
Maybe just to pick up, Frank, to throw something over to you. I mean, you kind of mentioned what the reaction has been, that some voices have kind of been a let them go kind of attitude. I don't know, to what extent do you think people are taking this seriously this time? I think Heiko Maas kind of had a comment like, maybe, you know, let Trump blow off some hot air, and kind of maybe perhaps questioning whether or not the United States will actually follow through this time. But I guess if you're looking at the kind of spectrum of responses that you've seen, how would you kind of lay out that landscape? And, you know, as for Germany, when they're thinking about implications for NATO, what are the biggest concerns that you are hearing inside Germany, other than what Ulrika said? I'm obviously it's a problem for deterring Russia and perhaps for NATO cohesion. But from a German perspective, is that where the emphasis is in these discussions?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, it keeps changing and adapting to the situation. I remember that I think in the last recording of our own podcast, we were already talking about this, or at least around that recording. And it was then where there were only the first rumblings of this. So there wasn't really, you know, anything tangible yet. And I think even myself, I said, well, let's wait and see, you know, it's the Trump administration, you know, things change all the time. Maybe 24 hours from now, no one is even talking about this anymore. Now it seems it seems like it's going to happen. And so there's probably a whole lot of things connected to it. I mean, Rico already mentioned this. For people in Germany, most immediately, this is in many ways an economic issue, because there's just a lot of commerce and you know, jobs connected to the bases themselves. So it is impacting specific regions potentially, in a serious manner. Whereas if you look at, you know, federal policy and the German foreign and security policy discourse, I'll be a bit cynical here, it might even almost be you know, quite welcomed, because it takes some of the heat off of Germany with regard to you know, for instance the nuclear sharing debate that we were having, which some European allies as being a great danger in terms of undermining NATO cohesion. Now we've got other NATO cohesion problems all of a sudden. So it might actually, some people in Berlin might think, wow, cool, now we're no longer the bad guys here. But it's still in developing. So we will see where we are at this a week or two from now.
You know, it's your point really interesting as far as taking the heat off of Germany, because here we have the United States that has come in and has been the loudest voice about nations have to do more burden sharing, Germany, deterrence, the Russians are on the march, we got to get battle groups into the Baltics, we got to do all this. So we come in with preaching to everyone there in the cathedral of NATO as we sit around the big table. And then we pull a stunt like this, where we pull troops out of Germany, totally undercutting all the points we've been making about doing more. The Russians are coming, you know, and there we are pulling. You know, it's just amazing in terms of that dynamic that you mentioned. How does this then reverberate among European allies who look on Germany and say, there's a sympathy vote. And, you know, instead of major allies coming up to Germany and wagging their fingers, you know, there Germany is being seen almost as a victim of this capriciousness coming out of Washington. You know, how can Germans plan what they're going to spend, where they're going to spend it, you know, what U.S. forces will be hosted where, the impact on the local communities, when you are tied to such a capricious leader that we have here. So in a lot of ways, you're right, there is some pressure taken off of Germany just in terms of a sympathy vote among allies who feel bad that Germany is being picked on by Trump. It's a very interesting intra-dynamic within NATO.
Yeah, and it's not like Germany doesn't have a point here, because, I mean, we have increased defense spending quite substantially. So we can actually put forward this quite credible argument that says we're doing more, just like you told us, and now you're doing this. Yeah. And it's, you know, in domestic discourse on all these things, one thing that is also not forgotten is that it's not that long ago that Trump was, you know, undermining Article 5 of NATO and was, you know, casting doubt on Article 5. And here we're not talking about the brain of NATO, but the beating heart of NATO. So if Article 5 were to, you know, be severely damaged, then we're in hot water. And this is not forgotten in Germany on many political sides.
Jim, I think you also mentioned something really important about inner European dynamics, because I think as a kind of result of what's happening now, there are two dynamics that are unfolding at the moment. So first is one that I would say is rather positive, and that is that more and more Europeans are realizing that we will have to ensure our own security by ourselves and not rely as much on the United States. And of course, you know, Merkel has said this and others have said this, but, you know, every one of these things that is happening kind of reaffirms this. And so I think in the kind of midterm, this is going to be probably good for European defense, because more Europeans will be willing to kind of work together on that. On the other hand, of course, there are also Europeans that may look at this and think, well, you know, if Trump doesn't like Germany anymore, and if the US doesn't want to station troops in Germany, maybe we can have some of those. And of course, you know, this is kind of the Polish question. There were these debates about Fort Trump or something like that in Poland. And it seems at least as if the Polish government would be interested in hosting some of those troops that Trump may be withdrawing from Germany on Polish territory. Whether this is something the Trump administration is entertaining or not, I don't know. If they want to bring the troops home, of course, stationing them in Poland doesn't really work, but we'll see. So that could be something that's happening, and that could be really problematic for a number of reasons. I mean, inner European kind of cohesion wouldn't be great. There's also a Russia issue, because that would mean moving US troops further east. Russia will not be amused. So this could yet be another problem, although in the current debate on withdrawing troops, I haven't heard that much about Poland. But this is another European dynamic that's kind of worth keeping an eye on.
Kind of taking us on in a slightly different direction, but Ulrika, you just mentioned kind of this impetus for Europeans to do more for their own security and defense. That's been an important trend that certainly accelerated in the Trump administration. But I wonder how you see COVID and the post-pandemic environment as affecting Europeans' interest and willingness to continue to invest more in some of these traditional security and defense issues. I wonder what does the conversation from your perspective look like in the post-COVID environment? Do you think there'll be support to continue with traditional defense spending? Do you see a move towards a redefinition of what security and defense is, to maybe there'll be greater appetite to invest more in global health, in climate related issues, for example? So kind of how do you think COVID might affect Europeans' appetite to do more on the security and defense piece, the way that we've kind of traditionally historically defined it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, at this point, yes, I've already seen kind of headlines basically saying, you know, is this really the time to buy whatever new airplane, and shouldn't we invest this money elsewhere? But that being said, this is like the very normal conversation in Germany all the time. There's always a question of, should we really buy tanks rather than finance kindergartens? Like, that's a typical headline. So in a way, I would almost say that, you know, defense spending is already, you know, not so high that maybe decreasing isn't necessarily like the biggest priority. But yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, I was somewhat positively surprised because I was worried that on the EU level, so kind of Brussels level, European defense would basically more or less be abandoned because there are so many other things we need to worry about, recession, all of that. But it seems to me that both Germany, that is now taking on the council presidency of the EU, and also France, that has been playing quite an important role on the EU level lately, they're still kind of pushing for European defense and are trying to make sure that this isn't being forgotten. So I'm kind of positively optimistic when it comes to the EU level. On the national levels, I mean, it really depends on how bad the economic recession is going to be. There is this kind of bad joke of, you know, maybe Germany is going to reach the 2% defense spending after all, because if the economy goes down so much, then, you know, the little we're spending is maybe 2% of GDP. I don't know. But it seems to me, I mean, maybe Frank has a different view, but it seems to me that so far we haven't heard these kind of big calls to cut defense spending in favor of something else. I think all kind of state expenditures will have to be cut a bit, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be defense more than everything else.
Yeah, I mean, we're still in the middle of the pandemic. So, I mean, some people seem to forget. So I'd be very hesitant to say this is how COVID is impacting this specific, you know, policy field. I'm totally with Rico on that. But you can see troops being mustered on both sides. So I do see language with regard to, you know, procurement projects, be they specific or defense spending in general, saying, you know, in times of COVID, this, we can't be spending money on this. And I see the other side saying, we have now barely gotten this increase in defense spending that we have. Now we're getting hit by COVID, so we need to do everything we can to basically hold on to what was already decided. So you see this, but it's way too early to tell how this will play out. I do not think that we will see a huge redefinition or basically a shifting of goalposts, what defense and security is all about. That's probably, even though, you know, the pandemic is quite a historic event, probably not enough. You know, just one interesting indicator is decided on a German stimulus package, which we have this terrible German word circling around. It says it's a stimulus package with a Wumms, so it says with a bang, basically. And if you look at what this bang is all about, it is about quantum computing. It's about a hydrogen infrastructure in Germany and, you know, carbon neutral mobility. And so right now, spending is going into all these future projects and in infrastructure, and definitely not in the direction of defense.
You know, it's a I'm getting a lot of calls from the media and others, and one of the questions that they ask about this is, do you think that things like PESCO and a lot of the EU programs to improve European or EU member military capability, is this going to give it a great boost? I think, Rika, you kind of mentioned that, and Frank too, and it's kind of in the background, is, well, if the U.S. is going to pull out and it's becoming obvious that we can't depend on the United States, we've got to do more, and therefore the EU program is going to get a big boost. And I wish that were the case in a lot of ways. I don't see it happening for a lot of other reasons that we can talk about maybe at another podcast, but I don't know. I was just going to ask you all, do you feel there's going to be, you know, some type of impetus towards, I won't say a European army, that's always been kind of a euphemism for just more, you know, military capability, but do you see with the U.S. withdrawal, this something happening to to build more of a European pillar. You know, Ben Hodges says a European pillar, not a European pillow. And and so I'm wondering if this is, you know, could this result in more EU efforts in terms of military capability, or really it's just going to be a continuation of kind of the do loop that we're in already?
I mean, I would never really use the term big boosts or big movement when it comes to European defense. It's always, you know, very incremental, step by step. I think, I mean, as I mentioned, I think this discussion, you know, even if it may not happen, but I think it will happen, this discussion about the withdrawal from Germany is just, you know, yet another element that shows Europeans that maybe relying as much on the US as we have been in the past isn't a great idea for the future. And I think so incrementally this will help European defense. But honestly, I mean, building up European defense is really tricky. You need a lot of money for that. We just established that there's, you know, not that much money around at the moment. And so, I you know, it's still hard. We would all be safer if there was more reassurance from the US. But yeah, so maybe it helps a little bit, but I definitely wouldn't say that there is any kind of big boost. I'm just happy that we're not kind of abandoning all of these efforts in the wake of the COVID recession. But I wouldn't go further than that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'm with both of you on that. I mean, it is very much evolution, not revolution. And you mentioned the European pillar within NATO, Jim. I mean, this discussion is, I don't know, as old as I am probably. And so we've always had this, and we already were talking about, you know, strengthening the European pillar and strengthening European defense. You know, when Obama did the pivot to Asia, you know, that's one of the things that I have very clear in my mind still, where we were thinking, ooh, now Europe needs to get its act together. Yeah. And sure, I mean, there's been more and more, and with Trump, we're kind of getting the same position, but with a very different rhetoric. But I mean, it is clear to Europe and has been clear for some time that, you know, both within NATO and in terms of standing on their own two feet in terms of some sort of European sovereignty, more needs to be done. So it's clear to me and to most people, I think.
The other issue that I think folks are talking about in the context of COVID is how the pandemic is changing European perceptions on China. And so I just wonder if you can say a little bit, have you seen any shift in discourse or in political dynamics around the China question? I mean, for example, in the UK, it's kind of changed the conversation around whether or not the UK will go with Huawei and 5G on 5G. So has there been anything noticeable? Have you seen any really qualitative shifts in the way that Germans are thinking about China in the wake of the pandemic?
Again, I would say not yet, but I have just over the weekend, you know, been looking more at China and listening to a couple of things, reading a couple of things, and it seems to me that we are very much in a process of reassessing, because I mean, it is clear Germany exports a lot of goods and exports a lot of those to China, and the double standard of, you know, having China as a trading partner, but on the other hand, then, you know, being silent on, you know, things like, for instance, what's happening to the Uyghurs and other human rights questions is more and more getting an issue for people, I think, in Germany. So this will also not happen overnight, but I can totally see that there will be some readjustment in that regard. And yeah, I mean, in terms of COVID, there isn't a clear position on this. Again, I think it's pretty early to say, and we will probably never know the genesis of the pandemic and where the virus, you know, originated. So it seems to me that people are looking more and more at German-Chinese relations, and people recognize more and more that we were under some illusion there. And you were asking about Huawei specifically. Again, very incremental steps, whereas the German government, the current government of Christian Democrats and Social Democrats, in the beginning was very, you know, liberal about the whole thing and said we don't want to exclude any technology provider from the competition. we are now at a point where there's basically a two-step process where there needs to be, there's a technical assessment of the components being provided, and there's some sort of political lever that they have now built in to be able to pull if the technology is doing something that they're not totally fine with. It is still a far cry from what other, countries like Australia and the UK have now, it seems, pretty much pivoted. It's still a far cry from that. But again, it's drip, drip, drip. There's more and more skepticism with regard to China, cropping up in political discourse over here.
We can shift focus a little bit. And this is an area where I don't spend a lot of my time. Jim has written on this issue, but I would feel remiss not asking each of you a little bit about what's going on with the nuclear debate. So I know that the SPD has really reinvigorated a conversation about whether Germany should remain under NATO's nuclear umbrella. So I just would, can you, for our listeners in particular, give the quick contours of what that debate looks like in Germany to help Americans understand what's going on there. And Jim, you as an expert in this area should also feel free to chime in.
All right. So there's a thing called nuclear sharing. And it means that within NATO, the US is forward stationing nuclear weapons in Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, and Turkey. And with regard to Germany, that means that we've got some 20-ish B-61 gravity bombs in a place called Büchel, in a bunker. And we have a plane called the Tornado, which is very, very old and which needs to be replaced. And the Tornado is the only system that is certified by the US to carry these B-61 bombs. So these are tactical nuclear weapons. They're called technical nuclear weapons, even though they can potentially have a detonation yield that is, 10 times of what the Hiroshima bomb had, but the idea is to bring them onto the battlefield. This is very much Cold War thinking, because the way this emerged is, you want to defeat huge, tank divisions coming through the Fulda Gap, and so you throw a nuke on there if you're super desperate. Now we're talking about, completely different scenarios in the Baltics and everything, but, that point aside, the weapons are here. The current German government is a coalition between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. And, around this whole decision cycle of we need a replacement for the Tornado, which plane to buy. So the F-35 would be a contender there. The F-18 and the F-15 have been looked at. And of course, the Eurofighter would be a possibility. Now, the question really is, depending on which plane we buy, do we get certification from the US to still have the plane carry the bombs? And obviously the US was signaling, we'd like you to buy an American plane to, carry the American bombs, and we will make sure that certification will then be way quicker than, for instance, for a Eurofighter. So there was clear incentive for the German government to buy American. And they now came down for... They want to buy the F-18, which is a bit weird because the F-18 itself within the US Armed Forces isn't even certified for the B-61 bomb, and it is being phased out. So it's not clear why they picked that one, but apparently that is what they did. And so within the German government, some within the SPD were saying, hey folks, let's use this opportunity and just get out. Let's get out of nuclear sharing. Let's no longer be part of that agreement and have the US remove the bombs from German territory. And then we had this whole debate of what does this do to NATO cohesion? What will it signal to the European allies and all these things? And it's a bit more complicated than that, even because some 10 years ago, we had complete consensus on this in Germany. Almost all the parties, I think, in the German parliament, in the Bundestag were saying, we want to get out of nuclear sharing. We want these bombs removed. So this once was a consensus from left to right. Ever since 2014, of course, and Russia's invasion of the Krim and Ukraine, people have began thinking differently about this. But this is basically the mess we're in right now. and it's still very much in flux, and it has been going on for years. Like, we've had a podcast episode in at Christmas 2018, where supposedly, you know, the decision on the tornado replacement should have been made already, and we were joking about this then, and now it's 2020, and we're still talking about it.
Yeah, and maybe to add, I mean, the weird thing about this whole discussion about nuclear sharing is that, and if I may plug here, we actually had a long discussion on Sicherheitshalber for the German speakers who are listening to that on nuclear sharing. And we kind of explained how nuclear sharing at this point doesn't in fact have any military value anymore. I mean, there really is no military scenario in which it is likely that some German aircraft is going to carry these US nuclear bombs into a battlefield. There's also very little, let's say, proven political impact that having these bombs on German soil really gives Germany. And yet abandoning nuclear sharing would probably, you know, a pretty bad idea, because it again undermines NATO cohesion and the whole system that we are basing, you know, our security on. So there is this weird situation where, you know, people like myself are basically advocating to buy an aircraft that is able to carry an obsolete system for a scenario that honestly I can't quite imagine. And yet I'm saying this is better than abandoning it. And so I think this has made this even more difficult, because this is a very tricky discussion to have. You know, there are no great sound bites explaining this. And so it's much easier to say, oh, let's just get rid of it because, you know, we can't use them anyway. And also we don't like Trump and stuff like that. And so this discussion has been a bit tricky in Germany. And yeah, it really isn't done yet.
You know, it is a complicated issue, and there's some emotion part of it too, and for the U.S. in a couple of areas. One is, can you imagine that in the midst of this drawdown of U.S. forces in Germany and the problems bilaterally, that on top of that, the German government comes out and says, and we don't want to do nuclear sharing anymore. I mean, that would just be, you know, for Trump, in terms of his politics, that would just feed the fire. So that's a part of the U.S. political side. But the emotional side, though, is, and we talked about that a little bit in an op-ed Michelle Fornow and I did, where there was a feeling that this is something that there is a bond between the U.S. and Germany and between the U.S. and Europe when it comes to this extended deterrence, this nuclear umbrella, that there is this you know, symbolic aspect to it. There's this aspect to it that isn't really associated, as Ulrika said, it's not exactly a military thing. I mean, you can talk about deterrence and that type of thing, which we could talk about, but there's more of this unity idea that we're all in this together, whether it's from conventional forces all the way up to the nuclear forces. And the more the Russians talk about the use of nuclear weapons in their strategy, in their military thinking, particularly after the INF treaty went away, suddenly this nuclear equation is back on the table at NATO. It's something we have to think about, because, you know, it's not the 1990s anymore. And the Russia we're dealing with now is very open about their potential use of nuclear weapons, and this fear of nuclear blackmail, where if there isn't a NATO nuclear response based in Europe, that leaves us ourselves open to a scenario where the Russians can rattle not at the United States, but at Europe, a nuclear saber, saying this is what we want, and they rattle this nuclear saber because there's not really a response to that within the alliance, the UK and France aside. That was the old scenario a number of years ago that really underpinned this extended deterrence, where Europe would not be vulnerable to that kind of thing from the Soviet Union, this kind of nuclear blackmail. But as Rika said, and it's very true, it's hard to see a scenario where this would ever happen. And the nuclear usage or the nuclear viability in a conflict is an extreme anyway, which is why conventional forces are so important, so that you have this conventional deterrent, so that you don't find yourselves in a situation of weakness where either side feels pressured to use a nuclear weapon or to threaten it. So it's a esoteric thing. It's something that only experts think about. It's something that is kind of newly on the scene suddenly because of Russia and what the Russians have said, the INF treaty. And then suddenly, in terms of the public discourse, those who talk about defense, all of a sudden the nuclear strategy, you know, is suddenly having to be discussed, even though it had been dormant for about 15 years. So it is a complicated thing. And you throw on top of that the procurement issues that Germany has to make. And again, Ulrika talked about that, you know, having to spend millions and millions on an aircraft that is certified to carry a nuclear weapon is just blows your mind. But that's where we are. And it's something I think that all of us have to realize that if we want to make a change in how the alliance does its nuclear strategy, it's not, to me, it's not like Germany is locked into this forever. We've got to have flexibility within the alliance to make changes to how we go about being a nuclear alliance and the role of nations. And if Germany feels we must leave this, then you have to go through a process where within the alliance, we think about the nuclear strategy and how we go about doing it. And a lot of it, I think Frank said this, a lot of this is Cold War oriented. So maybe there's a more modern approach and nations can sort out among themselves how they want to play a role in this. And so you go through a process, and if you do that, then it's not a matter of Germany walking away. You know, suddenly Merkel makes an announcement as a chancellor saying, we're not going to do this anymore. That's not the way, and that's not really what Germany was going to do anyway. But the way is going to the alliance and saying, let's rethink our nuclear strategy, and then trying to figure out roles that allies are more comfortable with.
Okay.
Go ahead, Rob. Sorry, can I just very quickly, because I think this is a really important point, because the thing is, I think, Jim, you're right. Germany shouldn't, nuclear sharing doesn't have to go on forever. It's not as if, you know, Germany has to keep these weapons forever, especially since we're saying militarily it seems unimaginable to use them. It's just that at the moment, it just doesn't seem like a good time to try and question all these things. With another US administration, I'd say, actually, why not have this discussion? Why not have a discussion of saying, maybe we can change this system if we agree that it doesn't really work militarily or politically anymore?
Yeah.
It's just that at the moment, all kinds of changes just seem to kind of undermine the alliance. And that's why I'd say, let's try to keep as much as possible as it is. And then we can see whether another time we can reform it. But absolutely, we should never just say like, oh, the system that we have is in any way perfect and we can't change it. On the contrary, there are many things that are a bit weird and we should probably reform. I just don't really see that we're able to do this at the moment.
Right.
It is very much a timing issue. Yes, couldn't agree more. And many of the things that you said, Jim, were resonating with me. Like, I personally hope for a NATO that finds different symbols for its unity. I mean, these weapons very much are symbols, which does not say that they're unimportant. They are important as symbols, but maybe we can find something else. I'm sure we can. It seems people are very fond of reducing NATO to this nuclear aspect, that we have these nuclear weapons.
Right.
I think it's overlooking that geopolitically speaking, NATO is having a bit of an extra sausage with that. It is not clear within, for instance, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, if this is even, you know, a clean thing to do. I mean, we've got the two key solution and we've lawyered all kinds of, you know, ways around the fact that it is a bit of a dicey thing that we're doing in terms of international law. And just imagine the Chinese going to North Korea and saying, oh, you only got, you know, this little amount of nuclear weapons, have some of ours. Okay. And some submarines while we're at it. And, you know, everybody would lose their minds and China could say, that's nuclear sharing. You're doing it. So, you know, in the long run, I'd be happy with finding maybe a different solution to all of that.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, we're long on time, but I want to end with at least a final question in terms of kind of what the road looks like ahead and how you think that we can help kind of restore or put U.S.-Germany relations back on better footing. And part of that question, too, is how much of this do you think is accomplished by a change in the U.S. administration? How far does that get us? And I know it's not all about Trump and there's not a snapback. We've all recognized that many times, but does that get us something? And then what are the other areas you think that we need to address to kind of to get things back to a better place?
Rieke.
You go first.
Oh, man. So I throw myself on that grenade. I would definitely separate substance and rhetoric. Okay, so in terms of substance, I think, as I said before, it's been clear to, you know, Europeans looking at these issues that Europe as a whole needs to do more. So that was clear under Obama. But and so this won't change with Trump, hopefully, in my point of view, leaving the White House in November. And so there probably won't be a ginormous change in terms of substance. In terms of rhetoric, I mean, it can't get any worse than it is now. So it can only get better.
Never say this, Frank. Never say this. Yeah. I largely agree. So if there was a change in the US administration in November, I mean, that would definitely get us something. We're not going to get back to these now mystical times of whatever the 1990s or something like that, where apparently everything was perfect, which of course isn't true, but there's this idea. We're not going to go back to that. There are changes. The world is changing. The US position in the world is changing. As Frank mentioned, it's not as if some of the things that Trump says haven't been said before by Obama or even Bush before. They just were said in a different way. So Europeans will definitely need to do more. Europeans should have an interest in kind of trying to guarantee their security themselves. But I think there has been a lot of damage done to the transatlantic relationship under this current administration. So a change there will help. But then there are certain things where I'm kind of worried that there are a lot of things being broken that I'm not really sure like how easy they are to unbreak. I mean, especially when it comes to, you know, international law and treaties and these kind of things, because there's really an element of trust that is being lost, and I'm not really sure how, to what extent this we can get that back. So it's definitely a problematic situation. Europe needs to recognize this, needs to do more by itself, but you know, certainly the transatlantic relationship isn't over, and there is an interest on both sides to work together. Hopefully we'll make it through.
You know, two more things, maybe.
Yeah, I would just add that I was thinking of this, Rieke, when you were talking, that it's almost like a correction in the stock market. You know, when I was at NATO and earlier on, for sure, the U.S. dominance, the U.S. Lecturing, the U.S., you know, I mean, you know, U.S. leadership can be good and bad. But I mean, you know, and so we were way over here, and there was a desperate attempt by the French and others to do a correction of balance where it wasn't the U.S. dictating to everybody, but there was a more of a partnership. And so I think what we're seeing, in a sense, is this correction happening. And it's a painful one. It's something where I think Europe is shaking off this idea since 1945 of the U.S. Being the patron, you know, being the godfather, in a sense, and Europe coming into its own. But it's been a very painful process for us, because the way that correction is coming is by U.S. mistakes and some U.S. characteristics that are just not very pleasant. That's causing Europe to say we just can't trust or be with, but it's painful for Europe too, because not only awakening to this issue with the United States and seeing the United States the way it is in a lot of ways, but it's a correction too, where Europe is saying, well, in that case, we have to do more, and that's hard too. So we're kind of both going through a very painful period of correction that I hope is going to end up with more balance between the two of us.
That's a good way to look at it. I mean, the America I see today is not the America of my childhood. So maybe that was just, you know, quite romanticized back then. But I can definitely, you know, say that there has been a notable change of perspective. But I think that the more Europeans are aware of the slowly but steadily increase of Chinese influence in the world. So this is really talking in a geopolitical sense. If you look at, for instance, the Balkans or the harbors that were bought in Greece and the Huawei and the technology firms being bought up and all these kinds of things, I think the more that is, you know, in the forefront of people's minds, the more they will say, okay, I mean, obviously, there's way more that unites us yeah. from a European perspective with the US than what separates us.
Yeah.
Even though there are differences, but I mean, we're all grown-ups, and that's, you know, how I think these things can be carried into a good future.
Yeah,
I agree. That's really well said, and it is a nice note of optimism at the end. I mean, we obviously, as transatlanticists, have a lot, our work cut out for us. I mean, this is, it's going to be difficult to get to this point of more balance, like Jim was saying, but I also agree that the kind of China agenda provides so much fertile ground for cooperation, and that can be kind of a common pathway forward to start to build up some of the trust and figure out those areas where our interests and our values align and use that as a foundation to move forward. So, yep, I agree. I have that little bit of optimism as well. And so I love when we end these podcasts on a more optimistic note. So I think we should end before we keep talking, because it could turn quite quickly. On all, you know, when,
that never so happens rare in with ours.
Yes, true. This has have always ends with, podcasts. It's all terrible.
Yeah, normally that's the way. So yeah, we can pat ourselves on the back for ending things on an optimistic note.
We again, usually end with German angst.
Yeah, I know. But and again, and it and also underscores the importance of having these conversations. Like, I love that our two Absolutely. Podcasts are coming together. It's a shared challenge. Again, we both have interests in making things better. So it was fantastic to have this kind of melding of the minds. And so we really appreciate both of you for taking the time to join us and the Zeker Heizalberer podcast. So again, we hope we get to do it in the future. It's something that we've been wanting to do for some time, and we should do it again in a couple of months and see where we are.
Well, thank you Definitely. So much.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.